Everything is working. Looks like it's... See if I can pick this up. Looks like it's not working.
Oh.
I tried it last night. There we are.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. Let's begin by indicating that today is Friday, April 3rd, 1992. This is Jim Boning talking to Dr. Leo Brewer in his office at Berkeley. Dr. Brewer, I know you were born on June 13th, 1919 in St. Louis. Could you tell me something about your parents and your family background?
Well, my father was born in Krakow, which was the part of Austria then. And he was a rather energetic guy and was getting into all sorts of political activities, and his mother was very worried about him. I don't know if he even knew his father. I don't know what happened to his father, but his mother raised him. And she was worried about him getting into problems. So she had saved up some money, and she gave it to him and said, "You go to America." So he arrived in New York, not knowing much English, and decided he really wanted to learn it. So he got a job in some small town in Illinois where he had to use English, and he really learned his English there in a short time, and then went on to St. Louis.
Why did he go to St. Louis?
I think he had a brother there who had come earlier and went to St. Louis. And he worked in a variety of jobs, shoe repairing and a number of other things. And my mother came from Vilna, which was then part of Russia. It's now part of Poland, or it's Lithuania, but I forgot what. But it's really Lithuanian and culture. And she, my father came, when was it? Must have been 1910 or so, somewhere earlier than that even. But my mother came during the war, actually. Mm. She got out of there, was able to get, she and her father were able to get to the U.S. And they came to St. Louis because she had a sister in St. Louis.
I see.
Her relatives. And that was where she, my father, met. And I was born in St. Louis, but they moved, I think before I was 1 year old, to Youngstown, Ohio.
No.
Where he set up a shoe repair.
How did they select Youngstown from St. Louis?
Yeah,
at that time, that's a, that's a big move to make.
Yeah, apparently they heard there was an opportunity there or something.
So you grew up in Youngstown?
That's right. Well, until I was about 9 or 10. And, well, let's see, I guess... yeah, I think they were in the shoe repair business while I was being raised. Now, my mother never finished high school, so when I started in kindergarten, she enrolled in high school and got her high school degree. So there was a lot of emphasis on education. My father had wanted to be a lawyer, go to school, but never had the time or the money, but both of them felt education was very important, and that was a message that really got across to me.
you have any brothers or sisters?
I have a sister. She was 7 years younger than I. And she came to... I better go back. This is when we left Youngstown. In the 29, when the Depression really hit, the business was so poor. He gave up, my father gave up his business there and moved to Los Angeles, again because of relatives. Mm-hmm. And so both I and my daughter were essentially raised in Youngstown. And
you had your high school education in Los Angeles.
Yes. I started, I had one strange experience. We moved several times in Youngstown and then moved to Los Angeles. And every time I moved, I had to change schools. And they would give me tests, and they'd always move me up a grade. So by the time I got to Youngstown, I was, when they did the same thing in Youngstown, I was 2 years ahead in school compared to normal age. And as I described in that Iron lecture about how I really tried to learn to communicate, took all those extra courses in composition, writing, oral, and so on.
What high school did you attend in Los Angeles?
It's called John Marshall, up near Los Feliz Boulevard. And even though we moved away from that neighborhood, many miles away, I still took the train and bus and walking to finish there.
Did you have any teachers that had any influence on you?
Well, there was a chemistry teacher convinced me that chemistry was interesting. And I decided then I was going to be a chemist.
I see. What kind of lab experience did you have in high school?
I enjoyed the chemistry laboratory.
The taking of the extra courses were to improve your communication skills, which you indicated was partly at the urging of relatives who said that was important. How did that fit in with a regular high school's
program? Oh, I was able to squeeze it in. I didn't have much trouble with any of the courses. Also, my handwriting was poor. My relatives convinced me, you better learn to typewrite. And so I was using typewriters for junior high.
How did you select Caltech?
Well, I had heard that it was an outstanding school in sciences, and I actually applied for a fellowship there, a scholarship, and you had to take these exams. Now, one of the things about my schooling is I didn't go around memorizing. I would try to get a model that would tie things together. And one thing, I have a very poor memory. I have had all my life. So I don't try to recall things from memory. I try to work out some way of tying facts together so I can predict them. And apparently, the way they pass those exams, some of the high schools, the teachers would have the students memorize all the answers. I didn't have that, and at the time available, I wasn't able to do as well. So I wasn't able to go there the year after I finished high school. So I went to one of the junior highs and took a number of courses, which I then retook at Caltech. And finally, my father had saved enough money to send me there. And after I got there, I then did get the scholarship there, as I did very well. Very surprising, a lot of the students who had top grades in high school, largely due to memorizing, really found Caltech very difficult. Some of them just fell apart. So it really fit into my way of attacking things. So I did very well.
Your concept of model building is sort of identifies your whole career. You've done that almost throughout.
Yeah.
Did you retake the exams then after you were in that year to gain entrance into Caltech?
I don't think I had to get entrance. I was to try to get financial help.
I see. Yeah. What was Caltech? What year was it when you started?
36.
36, okay. What was Caltech like when you started there?
Well, it had about the same number of undergraduates as now. That hasn't changed much. They've added a lot more buildings since. But I did live in the dormitory there, and had a single room. Part of the problem of being at a different age than the other students was that I didn't interact as much with the other students, and I tend to do everything on my own. And I sort of continued that at Caltech. So.
What courses did you start taking? Who were the instructors?
Oh, they were the, everyone took the same courses. And, for example, freshman chemistry, Linus Pauling would give some of the lectures. And Swift, in analytical chemistry, I found wonderful. He really convinced me of the power of thermodynamics and physical chemistry. Even though it was an analytical course, we had to calculate all the equilibria and kinetics and so on. And then Don Yost played a very important role. And then, of course, Lucas, who I did my research with, and had several published papers from the research I did with Lucas.
Well, can you tell me a little bit more about Pauling and Luke and Yost and Swift? Did you interact with them as an undergraduate?
Well, not much with Pauling, except for one decisive factor. I didn't, when we got around my senior year and it was time to consider graduate work, I didn't know much about other universities. And Pauling was the chairman of the department then, so I went to see him. I said, can you give me some advice on where I should go for graduate work? And he says, you should go to Berkeley. And I didn't even apply anywhere else. That was my interaction with Pauling. And he's sort of taken a paternal attitude to me ever since. For example, he'll often write me, I just saw your paper and there's an error in this place. he got very angry at me once. I don't know if I described that in any of the stuff I sent to you from the Irene lectures. Did I send you all the lectures?
Well,
just one.
Just the one.
Oh, no, I spent a whole week there. And on the Manhattan Project, when we were using these models to predict things, we decided that there were two serious errors in the values that everybody uses. One, the enthalpy of sublimation of graphite. The other, the sociology N2. So after the war, my first graduate student, Paul Gillis, set about to check the enthalpy of sublimation of graphite. The problem was that there were previous experiments on the rate of vaporization from the surface, which would correspond to very low vapor pressure if you assume accommodation coefficient for close to unity. But there was spectroscopic data that Hertzberg had worked on that they interpreted that the enthalpy of vaporization would be very much smaller than what you would conclude from the sublimation kinetics, and that there was a real barrier for the vaporization. And they were taking 125 kilocalories, whereas we wanted something like 170, enormous difference. And what Gillis did was do a Knudsen cell experiment, where he would reduce the size of the orifice, and if it were true that the vaporization coefficient was low, the pressure coming out of the orifice would go way, way up, and we found it didn't. We published this paper, and oh, Pauling was so angry, he says, you've destroyed organic chemistry. Changing all the boundaries. Well, of course, all I did was move them up and down relative to base, and he didn't change the thing. But he had to rewrite his book where he used the old battalion. And Hertzberg, too. In fact, it took 10 years before they finally conceded. There were enough other confirmations, and they finally had to give in and come up to 170.
You commented that when you got to Berkeley, you were tired of taking courses because you had taken so many at Caltech. Mm-hmm. What other courses did you have at Caltech?
Well, of course, there was the physical chemistry and the Jost inorganic courses, which I found very...
Who taught the physical chemistry?
I've forgotten his name now. That's one of my problems. My memory is so poor, and particularly for names. I've forgotten who it was, but I found it useful. And then, of course, I tell people that it was organic chemistry that made the physical chemistry. I mean, they say, oh, you were turned off by the organic chemistry. It was just the opposite, because Lucas really emphasized the value of bonding energies, physical chemistry, in understanding what happened in organic chemistry. And I realized how powerful thermodynamics and physical chemistry would be.
That was a rather unusual approach to organic at that time, wasn't it, to emphasize physical chemistry?
Well, Lucas played a very important role in organic chemistry in introducing Jean Lewis's, but then again later Pauling's, bonding energy concepts into organic chemistry. He played a very important role. So he was really up on... He never had a PhD, incidentally, but he had really learned a lot of what went on in quantum mechanics, physical chemistry, and thermodynamics, and applied it to organic chemistry.
You did research, as you indicated, you did some research with Lucas, and in fact published two papers. Was that expected, that everyone do undergraduate research?
And that was encouraged, to have people do undergraduate research. And we do that here at Berkeley, too. And it was a good experience for me, because he just told me what he wanted done, and I just did it all on my own. And really learned how to tackle research problems.
So he really treated you like a graduate student,
yeah,
didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Who were some of your peers, your classmates at that time?
Well, if I can remember their names, there weren't many chemists. There were only about four or five chemists, actually. Let's see, one of them, a chem engineer, Mickley, I guess was his name, if I remember correctly, who went on to industry. And, there was another fellow named Brewer. As far as I know, not a relative of mine. Then there was another guy, Leffler, in chemistry.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, he was at Florida State, I believe, somewhere in Florida.
Well, yeah.
I remember the name. So at Pauling's recommendation, you went to Berkeley, came up here. You commented about something that happened after you received your degree. You went camping with some friends.
Yeah, in the Sierra. And when we realized that the war in Europe was going to expand and we'd get into it, we figured we'd better get our PhDs quickly. So it took me just a little over 2 years to get on.
And you worked for...
Olson, right.
How did you select Olson?
Well, I had done this kinetics work with Lucas, and that was the sort of work Olson was doing, so I thought it was good. In fact, I essentially continued working on what I had been doing at Caltech.
Did you select that? Or?
Yeah, so I essentially... Now that... something from the, I guess going back to what the parents, my parents were always so busy earning a living that I was on my own, and I had to learn how to do everything myself. And so that was sort of a pattern I developed. And as I indicated, I decided I didn't want courses and convinced my advisor not to take them, and instead went studying on my own.
What kinds of things were you studying on your own?
Well, we, in Berkeley, we had a seminar then for graduate students and postdocs, where the people who attended were expected to give one of the seminars. And so I gave a seminar every semester I was here as a graduate student. And for example, the bifocal theory, I gave a seminar on that. But, things outside my own research, but trying to get a broader education. And that was something that Jim Lewis emphasized very strongly, the need for breadth in the covered whole field. And for him, physical chemistry, I don't know if you ever heard of his definition, anything that's interesting. And for him, that included meteorology, anthropology. Those were all part of his physical chemistry. And Bill Joke, who was a graduate student here before he became a faculty member, when he retired, told us an interesting story about the effect of Lewis's emphasis on breadth. When he was a graduate student, he went around the department and interviewed every graduate student once a week on their research. So he kept up on all the research within the department.
That work, though, was never published with Olson, was it? At least I couldn't find it.
That's right. I've never had... See, I went right into the Manhattan Project, and I've never had the time. That's one of those dozen papers that I'm hoping. Turns out no one's done anything like it.
Really?
And it'll still be worth publishing.
That's, almost 50 years after the fact,
I guess.
Right. Yes.
And
that's amazing.
So that's one of the... fact. That's part of the problem. I've tackled too much work all along, and I haven't had a chance to really write up all of it. Although I've written over 170 papers, I have at least a dozen important papers that should have been written up, but I haven't gotten them.
Who were some of your student colleagues here at Berkeley in that time period before you got into the Manhattan Project?
Well, there was Dan Kubachowdy, SRI down here, and Don Hildebrand, who's also, Kubachowdy's now with the electrical energy outfit down there. Hildebrand is SRI. Iring, Leroy Iring, some of the students here.
And what was Berkeley like at that time?
Well, it was very challenging, a lot of interesting work going on, and also being a smaller university, it had the advantage of, you had time to interact with other departments, geology, material science, and so on, and that helped you get a broader preparation.
So you completed your PhD in December of 42. And that's when Latimer asked you to work on the Manhattan Project.
Right.
What kind of a person was Latimer?
Well, he had a broad interest in thermodynamics and physical chemistry generally, and the use of predictive models for predicting data that were lacking. So that was what he emphasized to me. You go about and predict the properties of plutonium and all these other things that are needed for the Manhattan Project.
Now, at first, when he asked you to work on it, he couldn't tell you what it was.
No. But when I agreed to work, then he was able to tell. And that was one of the benefits of working at Berkeley, the Manhattan Project, compared to other places. We got the whole picture here, whereas in other places, they were just told about the particular thing they were supposed to work on. And didn't understand the whole picture.
Before Latimer talked to you, were you aware of any of the war work that was going on?
No.
So it was kept, where was it done?
Well, it was done, in fact, in the same building I was working in. Yeah.
I noticed a plaque out here on this building. I didn't realize that this was the site of the original cyclotron.
Yes. Well, actually, just beyond it, the building, just north of it.
So Latimer gave you a project which essentially asked you to, well, there were several things, as I recall. One was to predict the worst properties of plutonium.
Well, he always emphasized the fact that when you're using these models, there's an uncertainty range. So when you view that uncertainty, you have to take the edge for might be a possible value.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he meant by the worst.
One of the things that you had to do was to find something that would contain the
yeah.
plutonium.
Yes, so they could cast it. And we really assumed it much worse than it turned out to be, because we thought the melting point would be closer to that of uranium. It turned out to be much lower. Did I have in that Irene thing the report from Los Alamos about the effect of our containers?
Oh, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of models were you using to make these predictions?
Well, we were using some of the models that Latimer had used, but how things vary across the periodic table and so that. Using the lanthanides for trying to predict what the actinides would behave like and things like that.
Because you were really working in a totally new field. I mean, there was so must have been very little information that was
That's
available.
Right. So we had to really predict a lot.
How did you come up with the cerium sulfide?
Well, we looked over. All the refractories, after the war, some of our work was published, but this was volume entitled The Chemistry and Metallurgy of Miscellaneous Materials, and that was all work from Berkeley, and included Madame Kubachade and Thurman also worked here. But here was all the work
we
had done on none of this had to do with the actinide, but just the general variation of things across the periodic table. And we looked at all the refractory materials, nitrides, carbides, sulfides, sulfides, phosphides, and as we indicated here, considered their thermodynamic copies, and we even tabulated values of them, so we could calculate what would happen if we had something as reactive as we thought plutonium would be to. And we found the oxides would not work, and there our calculations were this type. With the oxides, with the small anion, you get the higher oxidation states, they're very stable. But when you have a reactive metal, they will often reduce it to a lower oxidation state, which vaporizes the gas. For example, we considered thorium dioxide and hafnium dioxide as containers. But you'll get reduction by a reactive metal going to hafnium monoxide or thorium monoxide. The sulfides, which have bigger anions, lower oxidation states, where you won't have so many sulfides, are more stable compared to the higher ones. And instead of just existing as gases, you can have solids. And so